No, I'm sure I will once I go over it on my own. I'm sure I'll have questions.
Okay, so when I say that that Daniel's a history book of the future, do you see why I say that? And again, the skeptics, they can do what they want with Daniel chapter 8. They'll say that Daniel was written after the events of Daniel 8 and Daniel 11. All right, but what about Daniel 7 with Domitian? What do they do with that? You know what they do? They just completely ignore it. They act as if it doesn't even exist. And others, they say, well, if we prove that Daniel was written around 150 B.C., which they have no proof of, but they assume that it's, then that proves that it's not a prophecy. So therefore, any other prophecy, we can ignore it because we've just proved that there are no prophecy, which that doesn't even make any sense. It just doesn't make any sense at all. It's ridiculous. It's just plain ridiculous. But anyway, be that as may, people do what they're going to do, right? So let's read, pull out your Bible, in 1 Maccabees chapter 4, just kidding. Verse 36. Then Judas and his brothers, so this is Judas Maccabeus. Jacob Maccabeus was the first one, the male first one.
The
patriarch, right. He was killed in an earlier battle against the Titus Epiphanes that was not successful. And at that time, thousands were killed, by the way. But then his son, in this case, Judas Maccabeus, he began a second battle in which he defeated Antiochus Epiphanes' armies and pushed them out of Jerusalem. So let's see what happened later. Then Judas and his brothers said, now that our enemies have been defeated, let us go up to purify the sanctuary and dedicate it. So they marshaled the whole army and went up to Mount Zion, which is Jerusalem. There they found the sanctuary a wilderness, the altar desecrated, the gates burned down, and vegetation growing in the courts as it might in a wood or in some mountain, while the storerooms were in ruins. They tore their garments and they mourned bitterly, putting dust on their heads. They prostrated themselves on the ground, and when the trumpets gave the signal, they cried aloud to heaven. Then Judas ordered his men to engage the garrison in the citadel until he had purified the sanctuary. Next, he selected priests who were blameless in observance of the law to purify the sanctuary and remove the stones from the abomination to an unclean place. Again, the abomination of desolation. And this is Hanukkah. And the eight candles or the eight lamps of Hanukkah represent the 8 days, where there was the oil miraculously burned, even though there was no oil left for 8 days, and that's the whole thing, which comes from here. So Hanukkah is celebrated by the Jews. You say, well, it's not in the Bible, so why do they celebrate it? Well, it's true. It's not in the Old Testament, but they celebrate Purim also, which is a celebration of what happened with Esther. All right? And Jesus kind of acknowledges Hanukkah, and he also acknowledges Purim, just an interesting little side note. Anyway, so it says in Daniel 8 that he will be judged. Antiochus will be judged. In fact, he died within less than a year of the time that his armies had been kicked out of Jerusalem. Antiochus Epiphanes died. Okay, so let's go to Daniel chapter 9. All right, the destruction of Jerusalem in 80s. Oh, that's right. Let's start in Daniel 9, verse 1. It says, in the first year of Darius, son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, who was made ruler over the Babylonian kingdom, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood from the scriptures, according to the word of the Lord given to Jeremiah the prophet, that the desolation of Jerusalem would last 70 years. Now, the date of this vision that he has is roughly 537. We don't know the exact year, because again, we don't have an historical record of this Darius the Mede, except in the Bible, which is the most accurate history book of the ancient world. All right, so we don't know the exact year. It's probably 537, maybe 536, maybe five, something like that. And Daniel's having a quiet time, and he's reading from Jeremiah. Now, he's either reading from Jeremiah 25 or he's reading from Jeremiah 29. All right? I guess it'll be in here, right? They have Jeremiah in here, right? Yeah, that's all. It has all the books, just has some extra ones. So I'm going to go to Jeremiah 25. I assume this is what he's reading, because it says here he's reading Jeremiah. It's kind of interesting, because Jeremiah lived at the same time as Daniel. And so it's kind of interesting that Daniel already considered the prophecy of Jeremiah as inspired within a generation or so of when these things were written, which is, that's kind of cool if you think about it. Anyway, 11 through 14. The whole land shall be devastated and reduced to a desert while they stay in slavery among the nations for 70 years. But when the 70 years are over, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation. It is Yahweh who speaks for the wrong they have done, and punish the land of the Chaldeans too, and make it a desert forever. So the prophecy is that it would be for 70 years. Now, the year is roughly about 536 BC. At this point, Daniel's been in captivity for about 69 years. Basically, what he's doing is he's reading Jeremiah, and it says 70 years. He's like, yes, God is going to fulfill this prophecy. So he starts praying that God will fulfill the prophecy to basically destroy Nebuchadnezzar and then restore the people. And by the way, when this happened, probably it was after 538, so probably the Babylonian kingdom had already been destroyed. Okay? So anyway, let me see. So I turned, verse 3, to the Lord God and pleaded with him in prayer and petition and fasting and sackcloth and ashes. I prayed to the Lord my God and confessed, Lord, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him, keeps his commandments. We have sinned and done wrong. We have been wicked and have rebelled. We have turned away from your commands and laws. We have not listened to your servant, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings, our princes, and our ancestors, and to all the people of the land. Lord, you are righteous, but this day we are covered with shame. The people of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem and all Israel, both near and far, and all the countries where you have scattered us because of our unfaithfulness to you, we and our kings, our princes, and our ancestors are covered with shame. How would you describe Daniel's attitude in this prayer here? Very humble.
Humbled.
Humble and humbled both. Okay, good. Those are not the same thing, are they? They're close. Who's he essentially blaming for what happened? The people, including himself. Had he done those things?
No,
he hadn't. So I really appreciate that. You know, it's tempting to say they. In our history, we've had some problems. You know, it's very tempting to say they did this. But I suggest you should say, unless you weren't around, like Jose doesn't have to say we did this, all right? Oh, he could, because Daniel wasn't even around. All right, I think we should say this is what we did. Don't say this is what they did. Say this is what we did, because that's Daniel's approach. And Nehemiah, if you read Nehemiah chapter 1, he does this same exact thing. Nehemiah says, we did this, not they did this. So, for example, people will blame us for the Crusades. You know what I do with that? I'll just say, you're right. I will accept blame for that. Even though I had absolutely nothing to do with it, and if it asked my opinion, I guarantee I would have told them, don't do it. But I think we should have the attitude of Daniel and be willing to take the blame, even for things we didn't directly do, because people that are associated with us did it, and I think that's the right attitude to have. Okay, great. I'm going to skip down. Let's see. I'll go down to verse 17. It's a great prayer. Now, our God, he basically says, God, you did exactly what you said you were going to do, and we deserved it, and you're right, and we're wrong. All right, verse 17. Now, our God, hear the prayers and petitions of your servant for your sake, Lord. Look with favor on your desolate sanctuary. Give ear, our God, and hear. open your eyes and see the desolation of the city that bears your name. How would you describe his attitude here? Begging? Another word besides begging?
Asking.
I would say the word that comes to mind is bold.
Yeah.
I mean, he says, open your eyes. Imagine. God, open your eyes. Give ear. So on the one hand, in talking about his sin, Daniel's very, very, very humble. But he's very bold. I like that combination. Very humble and very bold. So this is a great model prayer. I would say this is just about as good a model prayer in the Bible that we have, which is incredible humility, but also incredible boldness. The bottom line is, he is just finished having a quiet time, in which it said 70 years. And again, like I've said this a few times in this class, do you think he could count to 70? I'm pretty sure he could. He's well aware. So basically he's saying, you promised. Now, God, you deliver on that promise. I'm calling you out, essentially. Hopefully humbly, but I just really appreciate the boldness here. We do not make requests of you because we are righteous, because of our, but because of your great mercy. Lord, listen. Lord, forgive. Lord, hear and act. For your sake, my God, do not delay, because your city and your people bear your name. While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and making my request to the Lord my God for his holy hill, while I was still in prayer, Gabriel, the man I had seen in the earlier vision, came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening sacrifice. So this is great. So he's in the middle of his prayer, and the answer is already being given. He's not even done praying yet, and God has already answered his prayer. To me, that is pretty awesome. He instructed me and said to me, Daniel, I have now come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you began to pray, a word went out which I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. Therefore, consider the word and understand the vision. 70 sevens are decreed for your people and for your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. By the way, place is not in there. I don't like what NIV did. I think they're liberals who are watering it down. It's the most holy, not the most holy place. No one understands this. From the time the word goes out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there'll be 7 7s, 62 sevens. They'll be rebuilt with streets and a trench, been in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be put to death. We'll have nothing. But the people of the ruler who come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. At the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation till the end that is decreed is poured out on him. All right, so he says, from the issuing of the decree and restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now, if you go to the book of Ezra, there are actually three decrees of Persian emperors. The first one, oh, it's not in this slide. Fine, it's in my notes. The first one is, the first decree. All right, the first decree is in Ezra chapter 1. It's the decree of Darius in 536 BC. And Darius said, go back and rebuild the temple. Okay? Then in 520 BC, in Ezra chapter 6, this time this is Emperor Darius, not Darius the Mede. This is Emperor Darius, who said, dude, build the stinking temple. In other words, they went back to Jerusalem, and instead of building the temple, they built their paneled houses. And you can read about that in Haggai chapter 1, where basically God rebukes them. You're putting paneling on your house, and my Lord, my temple's not being built. What's, you know, the Persian ruler told them to build a temple, and they didn't do it. So in Ezra 6, he basically says, I told you to build a temple. Why haven't you done it yet? And they did. They completed it in 516 BC, exactly 70 years after the temple was destroyed. The temple was rededicated, fulfilling the prophecy in Daniel 29 and the prophecy in Daniel 25. All right? But then neither of those decrees was to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Both of those decrees were to restore the temple. They were not allowed to build a wall. And if you don't build a wall, you've not restored the city. There was a decree. It's in Ezra 7. That's the one Jan noticed in notes. That's the third decree. That was issued by Artaxerxes. We're talking 50 years later. Actually, 60 years later. Artaxerxes, you can read it, says to go and rebuild Jerusalem. And it included the wall. You know how we know that? Because that's what Nehemiah did. Nehemiah actually went back. He finally fulfilled the decree of 458 BC of Artaxerxes in the seventh year of Artaxerxes. The seventh year of Artaxerxes is 458 BC. All right? By the way, there's a book. It's very thin book. It's like this. It's by Pfeiffer called Between the Testaments. And it's real easy to read. And it covers all this stuff that I'm talking about. The Seleucids, the Antigonus, and Lysimachus, and Cyrus, Xerxes, all these guys. Anyway, so the decree to restore and build Jerusalem was not issued until about 80 years after Daniel died, which is interesting. Now he says 70 sevens. Now, what is a seven? What seven? 490. 490 what? Well, if you look in Daniel chapter 9, verse 1, it's years. 70 years. Basically, Daniel says to God, you said you're going to save us in 70 years. And God says, yeah, I'm going to save you, but I'm going to save you instead of 70 years. I'm going to save you in 70 times 7 years. So it's years both from the context, but also from the fulfillment. Remember Isaac Newton said earlier that history should interpret the prophecy rather than people interpreting the present times. So both because of what happened 490 years later and because in the context of Daniel 9, verse 1 and 2, it's years. I say it's 70 times 7 years. So let's do the math. 490 subtracted from 458 is negative 32, which would be the year 32 AD, except for the fact that there was no year zero. In other words, the calendar went from 1 BC to 1 AD. Therefore, we're talking about 33 AD. Now, according to this prophecy, what's going to happen? By the way, I have to say one more thing about that, but just for now. According to this prophecy, what's going to happen in the year 33 AD? It says, let me see. The anointed one, the ruler, will come. It says he's going to finish transgression, put an end to sin, atone for wickedness, bring in everlasting righteousness, seal up vision prophecy, and be anointed most holy. And the word anointed there is Messiah. In fact, the word Messiah, is used twice in this passage, both in verse 24 and then again in verse 25, the anointed one, the ruler, comes. So in other words, Daniel prophesies when Jesus will come to Jerusalem. Now, if you read it carefully, it says seven sevens and 62 sevens. And then later on, it says in the middle of the last week in verse, 27. So actually, the prophecy is that sometime during the last of the 70 weeks, which would mean somewhere between 26 and 33, roughly, somewhere in there. Okay? Now, the tradition is that Jesus was crucified in 33 AD, but it's probably not true. Most likely, Jesus was born roughly 5 BC, give or take a year, and most likely died in 30 AD. All right? Bottom line is, the prophecy gets it exactly right. That's pretty impressive. Okay? So, Daniel, and again, they like to say, well, Daniel doesn't prophesy anything. It's a fake book. written by somebody after the events happened. Okay, so you're claiming that Daniel was written after Jesus? Is that what you're saying? Or after Domitian, for that matter? Since we have actual copies of Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls from like 100-something B.C., really? Is that what you're claiming? Seriously? All right, that's pretty impressive. He says it'll happen in times of trouble. And then he says, the people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city. That the name is Vespasian. I already told you about Vespasian. But actually Vespasian left in 69 BC. It was his son, Titus, as depicted in infinite detail. If you read the Jewish Wars by Josephus, you can read about that. This is the triumphal procession of Titus when he came back to Rome with the items that he took from the temple. These are Jewish. You can tell apparently from the beards and stuff. These are Jewish prisoners from what happened as prophesied in Daniel chapter 9. All right. And by the way, Jesus says in Luke 21, verse 20, when you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, flee the city. All right, that's what Jesus said. And if you read Matthew 24, 12 through 14, Jesus is essentially quoting Daniel chapter 9 virtually word for word. And in fact, let's read Matthew 24, 15 and 16, just in case there's any question what we're talking about here. Matthew 24, verse 15 and 16. Okay. Yeah, here we go. So then when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the housetop go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get their cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for the pregnant women and nursing mothers. So the prophecy in Daniel 9 is not only that the Messiah will come to Jerusalem, but that later the king will come, he will destroy the city and set up the abomination of desolation. And Jesus also basically says, like it says in Daniel, did I read that part? Yeah, like it says in Daniel. So is the abomination of desolation the killing of pigs in the temple in 167 BC and the setting up of that statue with the face of Antiochus Epiphanes? Is that what it is? Or is it when Titus, by the way, you read Josephus' Wars, what Titus did was he offered pagan sacrifice right on the site where the temple had been destroyed. So which is it? The answer is both. It's both. If Jesus says it's both, then I guess I'm going to go ahead and believe that it's both because he has a right to say that. All right? Verse 27, it says, he'll put an end to sacrifice and offerings. That's exactly what happened in 70 AD. Now, there is a problem. Let me tell you there's a problem. Because the prophecy seems to say this will happen immediately. I mean, the prophecy seems to say that. But it was 40 years. So I believe that what happened was, if you read Hebrews 8:13, he says, what is old and fading will soon disappear. And he's talking about what happened in 70 AD. So God waited for 40 years. I think it's not an accident, 40 years. 40 is a number of God waiting. You know, 40 days in the wilderness, 40 days of the flood, 40 years, 40, 40, 40. It's a constant thing. So I believe that for reasons that are of God's, of his own thing, he basically gave the Jews 40 years to repent. All right? So when Jesus died, the curtain was torn in two. And for all practical purposes, Judaism ended. But God waited for 40 years. He let them perform sacrifice in the shell of a temple in which he did not dwell anymore. And then he came and destroyed it, and that was the end of that. Okay, so we have here in Daniel 9 the prophecy of the Messiah coming to Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple under Titus. Any questions, thoughts? All right, great. Well, then let's do Daniel 10 and 11. See, we're just going really fast here. All right. Let me see here. I don't have a lot on Daniel 10. There he is. There's Titus. This is the emperor who's Titus's arch. By the way, this is in Rome. I might even have taken this picture. I can't remember if I did or not. Jan and I were there. It's still there. And it's his triumphal arch in which he celebrates the taking of the captives. And these people in this picture built the Colosseum. Not literally, but it was the Jewish captives who built the Colosseum. All right, so here we go. So now we're in Daniel 10 and 11. I'm not going to read all of Daniel 10 and 11. It would get a little bit, a lot of details that are not really necessary for us. And plus, I'd run out of time if I tried to do that. All right, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, means the year is 536 B.C. 536 B.C., give or take a year or so. All right, a revelation was given to Daniel, who's called Belteshazzar, and the message was true and is concerned a great war. The understanding of this message came to him in a vision. Now, this is the greatest of all the visions in the book of Daniel. You know, this is the total blowaway vision beyond Daniel 7, beyond Daniel 8, beyond Daniel 9. In fact, this vision covers three chapters, Daniels 10 through 12. In verse 2, it says, at that time, Daniel mourned for 3 weeks. In Daniel 10, verse 8, I had no strength left. My face turned deathly pale, and I was helpless. Verse 16, he says, I'll read starting verse 15. While he was saying this to me, I bowed my face toward the ground and was speechless. Then one who looked like a man touched my lips, and I opened my mouth and began to speak. I said to the one standing before me, I am overcome with anguish because of the vision, my Lord, and I feel very weak. How can I, your servant, talk with you, my Lord? My strength is gone, and I can hardly breathe. After the one who looked like a man touched me and gave me strength, do not be afraid, you are highly esteemed, he said. Peace, be strong now, and be strong. The bottom line is the whole chapter 10 is setting up the fact that this is an incredible vision. This is the vision of Antiochus Epiphanes and of the abomination of desolation. Because like I said, the immediate audience of Daniel is the Jews suffering that great persecution in the 2nd century B.C. All right, so now let's get to the actual vision. So we did chapter 10 really quick. There's some cool stuff about the angel of Israel is fighting against the angel of Persia. And there's a kind of interesting stuff with angels. But anyway, chapter 11, verse 2. Now then, I tell you the truth, three more kings will arise in Persia, and then a fourth will be far richer than all the others. And that one is Xerxes. The fourth one is Xerxes. It's Cambyses, Darius. Anyway, Xerxes. And what's Xerxes going to do? When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will arise who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has risen, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven. And it will not go to his descendants. Now, this is about Xerxes. And you know the whole Battle of Marathon and what's that, the movie, The 300 and all that kind of stuff. All right. And then it talks about Alexander. And when he dies, his empire will be parceled out. So he's covering like 300 years of history in like two verses. All right. And then verse 5, the king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger. So now we're looking at the time of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. All right. So if you start in verse 5, go all the way down through verse 35. What he's going to give is a blow-by-blow, year-by-year, battle-by-battle, king-by-king account of the wars between Ptolemy and Seleucus. And Ptolemy and his son, Ptolemy II, Ptolemy III, Ptolemy IV, Ptolemy V, Ptolemy VI, Seleucus, Antiochus I, II, Seleucus II, III, Antiochus III the Great, blah, 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 all the way down to Antiochus Epiphanes. And the thing is, if you take a history book and put it alongside the prophets, you go, okay, all right, I can see who that is. All right, I can see, all right. And the details line up to the point where Like I said, even the biggest skeptic in the world, they do not doubt, obviously, that this is what actually happened. And so what do they have to do then in order to have this not be inspired?
It was written later.
Right. They're saying it was written later. All right. So here's what I'm going to do. So I'm going to read from my book on Daniel. Parse it out to four winds of heaven. The king of the south will be strong. The Ptolemaic dynasty, Ptolemy the first. One of his commanders will be stronger. That's Seleucus Nicator. It says one of his commanders will be stronger. Remember we talked about that? He went out and he fought against Antigonus and all that kind of stuff. All right, great. I'm going to read page 196. Okay. So hopefully I can find it. All right. Verse 5. So what I'm going to do is I want you to go to Daniel 11, verse 5, and you're going to read the prophecy, and I'm going to read the historical facts and see if you can see how the historical facts line up with the prophecy. So by 315 B.C., Ptolemy the first Sotor, the founder of the Greek Ptolemaic dynasty, will establish himself in Egypt. In a battle in 312 B.C. with his strongest competitor, Antigonus, he will rise to become the prominent successor to Alexander. However, Ptolemy's greatest general, Seleucus, the one who's defeated Antigonus, will break away from him to establish an independent dynasty in Mesopotamia. Eventually, his kingdom will become even greater than the southern kingdom of the Ptolemies. That's verse 5. Now, verse 6. After some early indecisive struggles, the Ptolemaic kingdom and the Seleucid kingdom will agree to share power peacefully. In order to seal the deal, Ptolemy III Philadelphus will send his daughter Berenice to marry Antiochus II Theos, the heir to this northern Seleucid throne. The marriage in 252 BC will serve to make the two empires political allies. After both the kings of the north and the south, Antiochus and Ptolemy, die in 246 and 245 respectively, the alliance will break down. The Odyssey, you get the idea. So if you're reading verse 5, 6, 7, all that, you can read a history book, and this is exactly what happened. But the point is, this is 300 years before it happened. It's all prophesied. All right? And you can see why skeptics are made nervous by this. How can they explain this? The answer is there's only two possibilities. Either God is in control, God rules the nations, and the Bible is inspired, and everything they believe is wrong, and they need to quit their jobs as professors of lying to people about stuff. Or it was written after the events. Those are the only two possibilities. All right? Great. Now I'm going to skip down to verse 21 because we're going to run out of time, and I want to go longer. Verse 21 is where it begins with Antiochus Epiphanes. So almost half the entire prophecy here regards the reign of this dude here. By the way, the Jews didn't call him Antiochus Epiphanes. They called him Antiochus Epimenes. Epiphanes means God came down, basically. And Epimenes means madman. That was their nickname for him. Okay, got it? All right, so in verse 21... it says here, he'll be succeeded by a contemptuous person who has not been given the honor of royalty. So if you read what happened here, basically he was not the correct successor. But what he did was he used intrigue and lying and bribes and power moves to essentially take the throne, even though his brother was supposed to take the throne. All right? Again, that's exactly what's being said here. Of course, it's being said, 300 years before it happened. All right. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure and will seize it through intrigue. Then overwhelming army swept away before him, both it and the prince of the covenant will be destroyed. Okay. So that's talking about the prince of the covenant. That's talking about the high priest. I'm going to go down to verse 28. This is sort of a boring detail to most people. To me, this is awesome, but this might be a little bit boring to you. The king of the north, and who's the king of the north? Is that the Ptolemies or the Seleucids? The Seleucids. Right, the Ptolemies, Egypt and South Syria. Okay, so the king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he will lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He'll return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Now, if you read 1 Maccabees, you know exactly what he's talking about. So what happened was he invaded. Basically, he nearly conquered the Ptolemies, not quite. And then a few years later, he came back. But when he did, Rome set this fleet of ships. That's Rome from the west, ships from the west. And basically, he was defeated. He's terribly angry, terribly upset. He blames the Jews. And he comes back and he attacks the Jews. So now, starting in verse 31, here's the account of what he did to the Jews. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress. He will abolish the daily sacrifice. They'll set up the abomination that causes desolation. We know about that, right? With flattery, he'll corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. So basically, with flattery, he convinced many of the Jews to say, yeah, sure, you know, set up a gymnasium here and some baths, and we, you know, bathe in the nude, and some of them even had uncircumcision operations where they had skin sewed over their male organs in order to be able to, you know, it's a terrible story. Okay, those who will rise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword, or be burned, or captured, or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble, that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the end of the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. So, again, it went back and forth. They tried to get rid of him. They lost battles. They were killed. Some of the Maccabees were killed. But finally, eventually, God supported them, and they kicked him out. So the wise will stumble, but they'll be refined and purified and made spotless. So that's what God's going to do for us. All right, almost done here. Next is Daniel 11:36-45. Now this is a description of the end of the Greek kingdoms. Okay, Rome eventually overcame all these different dynasties. And starting in verse 36, the king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god. Now, the king in this case is switched. It's now Rome. So from here on out, the king of the south is going to be the Ptolemies, including the last of the Ptolemies, she, Cleopatra. So at this point, we have Cleopatra and Mark Antony, who was the favored son of Julius Caesar, one of them, who was involved in actually Brutus, and he kind of took out Caesar. All right, so you've got Mark Antony and the last of the Ptolemies fighting a battle against basically, this is Rome and Egypt together, king of the south. The king of the north will be Octavian and his troops. Now, the famous battle is the Battle of Actium, which actually, the main battle occurred in 48 BC in this location. But then the fleets came down here. The final battle was fought in Alexandria, but then over here in the Promised Land. This is when Rome took over the Promised Land, finally. So this is the battle that led to the final end of the Greek empires, completely utter end, when Cleopatra committed suicide. That was it. It's also when Rome retook Jerusalem from the Parthian kings. It's a whole big thing, a bunch of history that you probably don't care about. All right, but anyway,
love it.
Verse 38, it says, you'll honor a god of fortresses. This is Rome. Rome's chief god was a god of fortresses, a god of battle, a god of war, a god of governments. Verse 38. And in Daniel 11:39, it talks about the client kings. One of them was Herod, by the way. King Herod was working for Mark Antony. And then after the war, he went to Octavian, who became Augustus, and said, hey, I'm going to work for you. And Augustus says, why should I take you? You are loyal to Antony. He says, right, I'm the most loyal guy around. Now I'm going to be loyal to you. And so what Octavian did was said, okay, great, then you can rule over Judea. This prophecy is a prophecy about the time that all that happened. Okay. Verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. It was primarily a naval battle. See that yellow arrow there? That's the ships there. All right. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. This is Octavian, later Augustus. He will also invade the beautiful land. Exactly what happened. His armies marched into Palestine. Many countries will fall, but Edom and Moab and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. It's true. At that time, Rome did conquer Palestine, but did not conquer Arabia. Exactly as prophesied here. All right. Anyway, he will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape, right? He conquered Egypt. He will gain control of the treasuries of gold and silver, the riches of Egypt, blah, blah, blah. But reports from the east and north will alarm him. So what happens is, you read the history books, the Parthians, who basically were the Persians, they were saying, wait a minute, if Rome takes over, we're in trouble. So they brought an army. And so he was besieging Jerusalem. He went and fought them. He beat them. He came back. Bottom line is, I'm going to go to Daniel chapter 12. Because really, all this stuff is somewhat boring in the sense that it doesn't impact the history of biblical history all that much. This is the time when Rome took over Palestine and all that sort of stuff. The bottom line is, I believe the reason it's Indian is because this is when the Greek kings who were represented by Antiochus Epiphanes were finally fully defeated. So if you go back to verse 35, it says, at the point in time, I'm going to take those guys out too. And then it happened about 100-something years later. All right, Daniel 12. Ah, awesome stuff. Okay, the time of the end. Now, like I said, Daniel in the Old Testament, Revelation in the New Testament. Revelation is visions of things that will, in quotes, Revelation 1:1, soon take place. Whereas Daniel is visions of the future, and it says these things will happen in the distant future. But in both cases, what they do is, at the very end, in the case of Revelations chapter 21 and 22, it fast forwards to the end time. And in Daniel 12, starting verse 2, it also fast forwards to the end time. So here we get a picture. This is by far the clearest picture of the final resurrection in the entire Old Testament. You probably are aware the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection and the Pharisees did, right? Paul kind of used that to kind of get them to fight each other there in Acts. That was sort of a cool move. One of the reasons the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection is because they only used the first five books. And if you look in the first five books of the Old Testament, the final resurrection is implied, but only quite indirectly. In fact, by far the clearest statement that there will be a final physical resurrection from the dead is right here in Daniel 12. It's the most clear by far. There's no other super, super, super clear statement. There's many indirect statements that imply that, but this is the most clear statement of all. So, Daniel 12. Okay. Starting in verse 2. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens. Those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, roll up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge. Now you have to understand, this little thing here is the end of the vision that started all the way back in chapter 10. Remember I said it's like three chapters. So basically this is the final vision that Daniel ever got that we know of. He's just seal it up, and that's it. Okay, so what he's saying here is, at the end of time, multitudes will arise from the dead. All right? And so, Again, when we die, we don't go to heaven. We go to a waiting place. It's described as Hades, Sheol, Abaddon, Paradise, different names for it. And so this is a prophecy that at some point in the future, Jesus is going to come back in a way that we didn't know exactly what happened, but everybody's going to rise and there's going to be a time of judgment. Now, let me see. You've got two choices, two options. Let me see. Your options are everlasting life or shame and everlasting contempt. Which one do you pick? Everlasting. Oh, good. A good choice. Good choice. It's clear. And it says, those who are wise, and that's one of the themes of Daniel, is wisdom will shine like the brightness of the heavens. In fact, he's even probably referring to the Hasidim, who were called the wise ones during that time. All right, so that's encouraging. Now, whoops, do you believe that you're going to be physically raised from the dead and have a new body? No.
Yes.
No, so the Bible says. Yes. That's what it says. Right, 1 Corinthians 15 is it's a body, right? It's a new body, different kind of body. I mean, a body. You're not going to be some floating around spirit. All right? So, wait a minute. Then, should you get cremated?
You get a new body. If he's going to give you a new body, then he gives you a new body.
He made a body out of dust on the ground. So
all right.
Can get my cremation.
Yeah, so. But this defies all science and all this sort of stuff, right? But you know what? I believe it. The reason I believe that I'll be raised from the dead and when Jesus comes back and be given this new everlasting body is because Daniel said so. This is Daniel said, there'll be four kings, four kingdoms. The fourth will be the strongest of all, but it'll be a divided kingdom. One strong, one weak. And during the time of those kings, the church will be established as God's kingdom and will outlast them all. Daniel also said that during the time of those kings, said that there'll be kings in the fourth kingdom, and the 11th will persecute the saints, will kick out three other kings, will change the set times and the laws, and be arrogant and all that sort of stuff. And that's the same Daniel who said that there'd be this prominent horned goat who will kick out and destroy the two-horned ram, and that it will establish the abomination of desolation, and that 1,150 days later will happen. This is the same Daniel who said that in the year 30 AD, the Messiah will come to Jerusalem to bring in everlasting righteousness, atone for wickedness, and seal up vision and prophecy. This is the same Daniel who said that there will be a wicked king who will come, who will have the abomination of desolation, all that kind of stuff. So then the same guy says, Jesus is going to come back, and we're going to be raised from the dead, and we're going to be shining forever and ever. You know what? I guess I just believe it. And then I ran out of time. Jen gave me the tea, which means I ran out of time. But thank you, Jen. So I can just kind of summarize. Basically, what happens is Daniel says, well, when's this going to happen? But God, what about me? Blah, blah. Kind of like Peter who said, well, what about him? Blah, blah, blah. And Jesus says, hey, that's my business. You know, mind your own business. Essentially, that's what happens. Daniel says, well, what about this? What about that? And it basically says, that's my business. You just be quiet. Do what I say. I'll take care of it. That's my job. That's not your job. All right? And so we'll just say that ends the book. All right, very good. Is there another slide? Yeah. Fill in the blank with your favorite issue. What about this? What about that? Mind your own business. All right, great.
Awesome, thank you.
Yeah. See you all tomorrow.
Thank you.
Good, now I can have my coffee. Yeah, all the other ones, the first session was 45, the second was 40. I just reversed it. All the classes will be